Welcome to the Writer's Weekly Podcast, a forum geared toward the writing enthusiast and those who want to make money from their writing. I'm Brian Whidden, Managing Editor of Writer's Weekly, and I'll be your host along with Angela Hoy, the creator of Writer's Weekly and President and CEO of BookLocker.com, a full-service book publishing company. Whether you want to learn how to become a professional writer, how to find writing gigs, or even publish your own book, then you come to the right place. We'll be discussing all kinds of topics relating to the writing and publishing industries. Don't forget, you can also click over to writersweekly.com. There, you'll find not only thousands of articles about professional writing, you can also find current paying markets and job listings to help you boost your writing career and even your bottom line. But for now, let's get on to this episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. And welcome back to another episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Whidden, and with me is Angela Hoy.
Hello, I love you.
Won't you tell me your name?
Hello, I love you.
Don't even try with the Doors with me. I was a Doors fan back in eighth grade when people were asking me, who's the Doors? That was before the movie came out. And then all of a sudden, all those people who had no idea who the Doors were suddenly Doors fans. Mm-hmm, yeah. I'm like, people, you don't even know.
You know, I was, if you couldn't get it, the artist, I was going to give another free book on Book Locker, so you blew it for everybody.
Y'all need to step it up. Send Angie some song ideas that I won't know. But not only do I have the 80s wrapped up, I was actually a 60s music fan when I was in junior high, so everybody thought I was real weird, but
why you're cool.
That was my thing.
Yeah. I would have dated you.
I know that. So, home office today, short and sweet.
Yesterday,
it cooled down.
Yeah. last night we sat on the back porch because a giant thunderstorm came in and the lightning was really close. And this doesn't often happen, but Tank was scratching at the door wanting to go inside because he was afraid. He was under the porch. He wasn't getting wet, but it was really, really bright lightning immediately followed by thunder. And then I did a... recorded it in fast motion. What's it called?
You did a time lapse
of the storm going through, and it was beautiful, but the clouds in the valley were racing to the north and the clouds in the sky were racing to the south. So I sent a text to our local meteorologist who attends our church, and he gave me an explanation of why that was happening and explained that was a cold front coming in. And we woke up this morning and it was 69 degrees. Now this is August 2nd. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Texas, lived in Florida for, 11 years, 12 years, and even here in Georgia, never have seen a cold front come on the second day of August.
But this year, wasn't it like March and April and even a little bit into May? No, March and April.
Yeah.
It was still cold. We were still wearing jackets in March.
Yeah.
And April.
Yeah.
It's global climate change. Mm. That lightning was beautiful. Now, between from where we sit to Lookout Mountain, I do believe I've measured it out, and it was around 11 miles. Mm-hmm. And that lightning was between us and Lookout Mountain.
Yeah,
it was in the valley.
Yeah.
And that was close, but it was awesome.
A couple of them we jumped.
Oh, yeah.
The lightning went, and the thunders just immediately struck. And, of course, before it started, we unplugged our laptops.
We had another one of those thunderclaps yesterday that started off to our left, mm-hmm. traveled over to our right, and then traveled back to the... You could actually hear it. It's like it bounced off something and traveled back the other way. It was weird.
Yeah,
weird. This is the only place I've ever... I grew up in Florida, and when I lived on my boat, gosh, I saw every storm that came through. And it's all wide open space there. And so, when the direction that lightning's coming from because you know which direction the thunder's coming from. But here, my gosh, the thunder goes one way, then it goes the other way, mm-hmm. and bounces all over the place.
It's pretty crazy. But what's awesome is we're what's our elevation here?
We're at 1,500 feet.
1,500 feet. So we can see, and we're at the top of the mountain, mm-hmm. and then we can see the valley, and then the higher mountain, Lookout Mountain, is across. What'd you say? 11 miles? 6 miles? Something like that?
About 11 miles.
11 miles as the crow flies.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's our That's our home office today, and we're going to be interviewing another one of our authors named Chris Emery. So Chris Emery grew up on a farm in Maryland. He earned his BA in Information Systems Management. He has over 40 years of IT experience, and he has been in software development, and he's been a chief information officer with the federal government. But he's also got another aspect to him, which is very unique. How many people do you know who have been a White House usher? What is a White House usher, you may ask? Well, I'm going to have Chris tell us about that. But he was a White House usher from 1986 until 1984.
94.
I'm sorry, 1994. He went back into, yeah. For 8 years, he was under the Reagan, the Bush, and the Clinton administrations. And one unique claim to fame he has, he was the only usher to be fired in the 20th century. And we'll get into that interesting little tidbit in a little bit. Let him explain how that happened. Chris has written 4 books with us. First one was White House Usher, Stories from the Inside, and that is his true account of his time working inside the White House. Who Killed the President? That is a fictional novel that he wrote. And then Who Shot the Speaker? Another fictional novel. And the latest work he's done with us, The AI Candidate. And his books sell very, very well here with us at Book Locker. So, Chris, is there anything? Well, first of all, Chris, welcome to the Writers Weekly podcast.
Well, thank you.
We've been working with you for so many years, and today's the first time we ever got to hear each other's voices, which is pretty cool.
Crazy. We started together in 2017.
Yeah, and I also want to add that, because we pulled you up on the video, you look a lot younger than I thought you were.
I am. Yesterday is my birthday. I turned 68.
You do not look 68. Wow. Oh,
that's very nice.
I was thinking maybe early 50s, so... We should put a picture of him under the podcast.
Well, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Now, for our listeners, Angie and I are going to sound a little weird because we're passing one microphone back and forth to each other because we've had a little bit of a technical difficulty. So rather than being on his own audio, Chris is actually on our phone with a microphone pointing at it. And Angie and I are actually passing a microphone back and forth to each other. And basically when one of us has something to say, we're going to grab it from the other. So let's see how this works. So... Chris, anything else that I might have missed in your intro? I am kind of curious about one thing. Did you start out with the IT stuff and fall into the usher position, or vice versa?
No, actually, I was a computer programmer. They call them coders now. I was actually writing programs back in the 80s. And one day at the office, I was looking through the prior Sunday's Washington Post, and I saw an ad in the paper that the Executive Office of the President, Office of Administration of the Reagan White House, they were looking for computer specialists. And I thought, wow, you know, I've got to get a rejection letter from those guys. How cool would that be? So I printed out my resume on a dot matrix printer. Most people don't even know what that is these days, but it's very old technology. And I mailed it to the White House, and I figured, okay, I'm going to get this rejection letter. I'm going to run around my office showing people who wrote to me, not letting them read the letter, but just see the letterhead. Well, it backfired. I actually, several months after I sent that in, I got a call from the White House, and I thought it was a joke, and they're reading for my resume, and I say, Mr. Emery, are you still interested in the position? I said, of course, and this was in December 1985. I interviewed in December, and they hired me, and I started working in the Reagan White House in January 1986, and my job was office automation for all the offices in the West Wing and the senior offices in the Executive Office Building next to the White House. And I was having a great time. I was doing real well. One of the coolest assignments I got was to automate the inventory system that the executive residence, the actual home of the first family, they have an inventory system that keeps track of their consumables. A lot of people don't realize that the president and first lady pay for what they consume.
I didn't know that. I thought they got handed everything.
So this system tracked all that, and they got a bill at the end of the month. The project was a great success, and I fell into the position of the usher's office, which I was down working on this system with in a storeroom of the White House. All the guys down there were saying, "Hey, Chris, one of the ushers is retiring." I didn't even know what an usher was. I said, "Yeah." And they said, "You should apply for that." And I said, "What? Look, I'm in technology. I'm on the bleeding edge. You know, I've got my career set. What's an usher?" And they looked at me like I had two heads. So I started researching what it was. And the usher's office is actually the managing office of the home of the first family. They take care of everything, all the staff. There's 90 people that work in that building. You know, we have plumbers, electricians, chefs, maids, housemen. There's a curator's office. All the, you can imagine, to run a 132-room mansion on 18 acres of grounds.
Did you say 132 rooms?
Did I what?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you say 132 rooms?
Yeah, 132 rooms in the mansion, the executive mansion, the executive residence of the White House.
Wow.
I had no idea.
Yeah, actually, if you're standing in Lafayette Park looking at the White House across Pennsylvania Avenue, it looks like a two-story house. It's actually eight floors.
Oh, are the rest of them underground?
Several are underground. When Truman did the renovation from 1948 to 52, and this is not classified, he added a bomb shelter way beneath the White House, and then we added several, you know, mechanical, you know, HVAC rooms and floors to handle all the support for the house. Plus, there's mezzanines. But when you're looking at that, looks like a two-story house. There's actually four stories above ground, but there's mezzanines in between. So it's really hard to tell when you're just looking at it.
Yeah, I never knew there were that many rooms. That's wild.
Me neither. Boy, we've already learned this today. Wow.
So back to how I ended up in the usher's office. I got the job, and I started there not long after I got into the Reagan White House. And then, of course, as an usher, I was only the 18th person in history to have that position.
Incredible.
And it's a position that's really, my boss told me, he said, "Well, you know, there's only two ways you'll leave here. You'll either die or you'll retire."
Well, they had a surprise for you, didn't they?
that's in the book. But I was the luckiest person in the world. I had daily interaction with the president of the United States. And I also met a total of seven presidents in that position. Plus, I met all kinds of other really interesting people. And it was just, I was really fortunate.
Okay, so Chris, your first book, White House Usher, Stories from the Inside. Now, again, you were there from the Reagan administration through the Bush administration and into the Clinton administration. We're going to do our absolute best to keep politics out of this, but I can't promise you anything.
Now, just so we're all on the same page, are we not giving away the secret of how you lost your job?
Oh, he's going to give it away.
Oh, he is?
I think you will. Oh.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's in the book. I don't know if it's a spoiler, but.
Right. That's what I was wondering.
We're going to let you tell whatever you want about that, but that's down the road.
List. Okay.
Okay. The book's content is a collection of your own personal notes, kind of like diary entries. So tell us about that. How'd you come to that decision?
Well, you know, I took notes feverishly for 8 years, just really with the thought that these would be great things to share with my family. And again, I was expecting to be there really probably until now. I was planning on four years there.
Yeah.
And by the way, I do warn people that the story doesn't end well in the book, but we'll get to that.
Yeah.
I always took notes. Plus, I was the guy in charge of the there's actually a diary that what we call the usher's office log, which logs every time the president and first lady do anything, go anywhere. That was my project. So I set that up. So I had all that information. Plus, I would always add anecdotal notes to that. And the idea was never to find something to ever embarrass any member of the first family. It was just to have an accurate history of some of the things that took place while I was there.
We are learning so much right
now. And I gotta say, in today's political climate, it's shocking. And it shouldn't be. And I'm sure there are a lot more people like you, but it's kind of surprising that somebody left the kind of job you had and didn't go off and write a big tell-all and offer up a bunch of secrets on this guy or that guy, whatever.
Brian, I had an offer from a publisher in New York, came to my house, sat and met with me for 2 hours in my living room. And Angela, you're not gonna believe this. He offered a 6-figure advance.
Wow.
For me. And then he told me they would tell me what to write.
Wow.
Oh yeah.
And I said, no, thank you. That's not what I'm about. But I had offers. I had everybody's very interested in my story until they understood that I wasn't going to do anything that would be a scandal or cause headlines.
Wow.
I got a great story. You all know Tom Clancy, of course.
Yeah.
Well, Tom Clancy, a friend of mine was a friend of Tom Clancy's, and they were discussing my firing from the White House. And Clancy told my friend, he said, well, here, give him my phone number. Tell him to call me. So I get this wrinkled up piece of paper and with a pencil written phone number. I call it. Tom Clancy answers the phone. I said, Mr. Clancy, this is Chris Emery. Before I could finish, he goes, I know, I was waiting for your call. I said, sir, I'm considering writing a book, but you know, I've never written a book before. And he says, neither did I until 10 years ago.
No. Wow. Cool.
And then he says, tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you the name of my agent. Tell him we talked and see how he can help you. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this is incredible. So I did. I reached out to the agent. I shared some excerpts of the things I wanted to write. And we went back and forth. And finally he came to me and he said, your stuff is 2 Reader's Digest.
Yeah.
What?
I'm thinking, at the time, Reader's Digest had like 9 million circulation. I said, what's wrong with that? And he said, we want something that's going to cause headlines and sell books.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. Wow.
And I said, well, that's not what I'm about. I'm going to tell the story about the usher's office and I'll share some anecdotes, but there's nothing here that would ever embarrass anybody.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you know, good luck. And that was it.
Gosh, today's climate that anybody who goes off from the White House and tells that secrets might have to watch out for their back for the rest of their lives.
Well,
yeah.
My next question kind of falls into that. So did you have to get any of this stuff cleared by anyone before the book could be published?
No, actually, I never, in those days in the usher's office, we weren't required to sign NDAs.
Wow.
Since I was working on this while I was still in the government, I was at the Department of Justice, and I did seek to get their approval that of the project. I mean, I told them what the theme was and what it was about. So I covered myself there. But although at that time it was a little bit political. It was during the Obama White House and the justice people didn't want to give me permission to do what I was doing.
But you didn't really need their permission because required to sign an NDA back then. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No NDA. So we can't really completely dismiss the idea of a tell-all coming out someday.
Well, there have been 3 ushers in history that have written books. The first was a guy named Ike Hoover, who actually worked at the White House from 1898 till 1932. And he wrote a very long book. It's rather boring. the next guy is named J.D. West. He was an usher from 1941 until 1967 or 68. And he wrote a book, Upstairs at the White House was the title, My Time with the First Ladies. And it's not bad. It's not bad. So no other, there have been as I mentioned, I was the 18th to have that job.
Yeah.
There have been a bunch since then because several were fired, but after, in the last 20 years.
So there's a couple of little stories that I picked out from your book that I want to ask you about, and then I'll let you tell us any that come to mind to you that you want to share with us. But can you give us a little overview about the panic alarm coming from Nancy Reagan's study?
You know, that's a great story. That was my first week in the usher's office, and the panic alarm goes off, and well, I didn't know what it was. The Secret Service were running up the steps, and my job was not to allow them into the private residence. I had to be up there first. So I ran ahead of them. I said, "What's going on? Mrs. Reagan, panic alarm." So I get up there into the private residence. It's morning time. The president's already gone to the Oval Office. And I'm thinking, what do I do now? And I said, where'd the alarm go off? And, you know, they're looking at floor plans from 1802. So they don't know the names of the rooms and stuff. So I started doing a search for Mrs. Reagan, and you know, I went to her bathroom. I'm listening. There's nothing there. She's not there. I'm calling her. I said, "Mrs. Reagan," and I hear her say, "Yes." I said, "Mrs. Reagan, it's Chris. Where are you?" And she says, "I'm right here." And I'm thinking, I can't tell where her voice is. So finally, I open the bedroom door. She's in bed watching Good Morning America, and she looks at me kind of startled. I said, "Mrs. Reagan, I'm so sorry to disturb you, but your panic alarm went off." And she just looked at me and she goes, "Yeah, I accidentally hit it. No problem." And, you know, I felt so bad because, you know, she's laying there in a nightgown. She's got cold cream on her around her eyes. Thinking, I'm fired. Yeah. I intruded on their privacy. So I went back downstairs and told my boss. I said, Gary Walters was his name, Chief Usher. And I said, I blew it. I just went up and intruded on the First Lady. He goes, "Why?" I said, "Because of the panic alarm." She goes, "She expects that. Don't worry about it. It's happened before."
Oh,
it's happened before. It's interesting now.
Reagan and I got along great. He was wonderful.
It's really interesting that the Secret Service, I mean, their job is to protect these people, but they're not allowed in the private residence without you guys there. That's really interesting.
It is interesting.
Well, I shouldn't say they're not allowed. Our rule was to not have them intrude on the First Family.
Yeah.
The First Family, if they're going to be interrupted, they expect it to be one of us.
I see. Okay.
And so I just wanted to beat them to it. And they were very respectful. They understood because we were in charge of that area.
Well, and I guess they would assume that any real threat's going to be caught somewhere between that fence and the White House. By the time it gets in the White House, everyone's going to know there's a problem. It's not going to come right out of the bedroom. So
hope, yeah.
Yeah. So it would be more of something maybe like a medical emergency or something rather than somebody trying to kill them. So yeah, that I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
By the way, since you mentioned intrusion, there's a great scene in my first book, my next book after the White House Usher Stories from the Inside, where I talk about how to invade the White House. Anyways, fictional.
Interesting.
I noticed. I'll tell you this. I heard from the Secret Service, and they actually changed some of their procedures based on that book.
Which book is that?
Who killed the president? Remember. Yeah, going through that book, you got maps of the White House, of the interior of the White House, all at the beginning of that book, and I'm like, is he allowed to do that?
Are these real?
Yeah. You know, what's funny is actually those were from the original floor plan from 1798.
Oh, okay. I guess we're safe then.
In 1798 to 1802.
Okay.
Yeah. And those were the original floor plans. And those are the absolute walls. So, yeah, wow. I decided because of the who killed the president, a lot of it is in the White House. Uh-huh. And so you need to understand the layout to understand what's going on.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right. So now let me ask, how much and what kind of training did you have to go through to become a White House usher?
Or were you just thrown in there?
That's so interesting. Everybody thought, did you work in a hotel? You know, what did you? No, I was a computer guy. I think that my boss was keen on hiring the person based on the character and what how the person communicated and things like that.
That makes sense.
So I had to learn on the job, basically.
Wow. Okay.
Hey, I imagine if I was looking for somebody for that job, I would probably pick the most professional, kindest, friendliest person that everybody likes to be somebody to take care of the first family. That's what I would be looking for.
Well, what I was...
That's absolutely right. That's right.
Yeah.
What I was kind of picturing when I was reading a bunch of the stories was, Are you the guys that are like setting up tables for dinners? Do you need to know where all the silverware and the 20 different plates go, or how a room needs to be, you know, set up for, you know, dignitaries and stuff? I mean, are there just people there that know that and kind of pass it on down?
Well, so basically the butlers do all the table settings, and they reported to me. Unfortunately, they've been doing the same thing for 200 years, so they know what they're doing.
Oh, yeah.
All of them, they're not 200 years old. I'm talking about generations of butlers that have been working at the White House. A lot of them are related, by the way.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so as far as moving the furniture, we have a moving crew. But my job is to make sure I get the proper description from Mrs. Reagan. She's dealing with me firsthand. So she goes, you know, I'd like this set up, and I want, you know, people to arrive here. The entertainment's going to be here. She knew all that stuff. And so I just made sure I could interpret what she was telling me. Same with Mrs. Bush and same with Mrs. Clinton.
Yeah. Mm. So you would get the instructions from the first lady and you would convey those instructions to the butlers and the moving people, and everybody would make sure everything. And you made sure everybody did their jobs right.
Right. And what we also had rehearsals. We would do for a state dinner. We would rehearse that even with the chefs, that they prepare what they were going to prepare. And then we would serve it to the president and Mrs. Reagan. You know, a week earlier, and they would tell us what they thought or what we had to change. So yeah, there's a lot of planning, a lot of preparation. Of course, that's what we do. But it always worked out real well. I mean, we rarely had any mistakes, and certainly none that you guys ever read about.
Yeah, no kidding. How many ushers are on duty at any time?
Well, there's a chief usher, and then there's three assistants. I was one of the assistants. And basically, we cover the awake hours of the president. So our schedule, daily schedule, if you're on day work, you get in about 5:45 in the morning, and you leave about 3. And then the evening usher would come in at 2:30 and be there until the president went to bed. Now, me being in charge of events meant if there's anything official going on and I was day work, I'd end up working, seriously, 18 or 20 hours.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah.
Jeez.
Wow. Okay. Another story. Tell me about filling the White House with smoke from a fireplace.
Oh, I can't wait.
That's a great story. Yeah. Actually, that was the night the President Mitterrand of France was coming. It was an official but private dinner on the second floor. And it was springtime, and Mrs. Reagan was always cold. And it was borderline. I mean, it was like springtime out, but she wanted a fire in a fireplace. So one of the butlers lit the fire, you know, a couple hours in advance of the dinner, but he never opened the flue.
Oh, boy.
So the room filled with smoke. He's panicking. He's calling the usher's office. We're running up there. We're grabbing logs, throwing them off the Truman balcony on the south ground. Can I get the smoke to come down? And, you know, it was just unbelievable. We never told the Reagans. The Reagans were in their room. They didn't know what was going on.
They never knew.
Reagan came out, and she said, okay, I'd like them in the yellow oval room for cocktails. And we said, Mrs. Reagan, we've got a little problem. Because we got the fire out, but the room smelled like a forest fire. You know, you could smell the smoke.
Tears in my eyes. So the Reagans, when they were getting ready, they didn't see the burning logs flying by their window? You don't have to answer that question.
My duty for the night was rolling around Peggy Lee, you know, the singer, the entertainer Peggy Lee. Well, she was up in years. And so she was the entertainer for the dinner. So I was pushing her around in her wheelchair, and she had this long fedora, you know, this long scarf thing that kept wrapping around the tires of the wheelchair. So every 3 feet I'd push her, I'd have to stop and untangle the scarf.
Choking her with it.
There's a great, oh my God. There's a great, that's a chapter, that's a story in the book. It's really funny.
One thing you said about that fireplace incident that I thought was hilarious was there hasn't been this much smoke in the White House since the War of 1812.
since the British burned the White House.
Yeah, exactly.
It's actually 1814, August of 1840.
1840, yeah. Yeah, they burned down the White House, yeah.
Goodness.
Well, speaking of rolling around in a wheelchair, do you know what story I'm about to ask you about?
Yes, I do.
I'm going to let you take it away.
So the normal routine at night when the president retires, either Mrs. Bush would call, in this case it was the Bush White House, Mrs. Bush would call me, she says, Chris, you know, it's like 9:30. She goes, go home to your family. I said, yes, ma'am, I'm out. But when you close down at night, you have to go up and make sure all the lights are off in the private residence. They control the lights in their bedroom, but I mean, I'm talking about the office, the different parlors and all the rooms. So I was doing my routine. I've been doing this for 8 years. So I get up there and I said, I was thinking of FDR. You know, FDR was in a wheelchair. A lot of people didn't realize. And I said, what was it like for him to roll around up here? So I found a wheelchair in a closet up there. And I decided I was going to be FDR. So I sat in the wheelchair and I went around to each room, turning off the lights in the wheelchair.
Can I interrupt real quick? I believe that was the wheelchair that they had in there for either it was left over from when Gerald Ford had some injuries, or it was when Reagan was being wheeled around after being shot.
No, it was actually Gerald Ford's wheelchair. You're right.
Okay.
Okay. So here's the challenge. I get to the top floor of the White House. And by the way, President Reagan spent a lot of time in what's called the solarium after his assassination attempt. He recuperated up there. It's the highest point in the residence of the White House. And there's a ramp that leads up to there. And it's pretty steep. So I'm thinking, I started rolling as fast as I could to get up this ramp. I got like all the way up and I lose control. So I tried three or four times and I realized if I go backwards, I can get up there. I went backwards on the wheelchair and got to the solarium, turned off the lights, and then I came down the ramp. But I was coming forward, and it was fast. I lost control. So I get back down to the third floor, and there's this big octagonal historic table there with this vase from the Ming Dynasty or something.
Oh, geez.
And I hit the table.
Oh, God.
And I'm watching this vase rock back and forth, and fortunately it didn't fall over, but man, I was so close.
And that's not why you got fired.
I'm sorry, what?
And that's not why you got fired.
No.
Did anybody
get back to the main floor? And I'm turning off the rest of the lights, and I hear this voice behind me. Chris, what are you doing? I turn around, it's Barbara Bush. I look at Mrs. Bush, and I say, I was trying to see what it's like for FDR. And she just looks at me. She's trying to keep from laughing. She's looking at me. She goes, Chris, go home. But what's funny is in the foreword, she wrote the foreword to my book.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you to mention that. Yeah.
She wrote the foreword and she mentioned that. She goes, I even caught him one time in FDR's wheelchair.
What a sweet lady, huh?
Yeah, really, really sweet. But see, you can see I had some fun. I mean, it was a very serious job, but I had fun.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I had a good time.
So let's go ahead and talk about your termination as an usher for the White House. What happened there?
Well, it was put it bluntly, it was a sucker punch. You know, it was a March day in 1994. My boss calls me into his office and he said, Mrs. Clinton is uncomfortable with you.
Hmm.
And I just stared at him blankly. What do you mean she's uncomfortable? How? He goes, that's all I know. And I said, what does this mean? He goes, it means tomorrow will be your last day.
I know why she was uncomfortable, because you're a computer guy.
I'm fired. He goes, yes. I said, well, why would I come back tomorrow to be fired? I'll leave now. And it was a mystery and a shock. I got to my car on the East Exec Avenue next to the White House, and I called my wife and I said, I have some good news and bad news. The good news is I'm off tomorrow.
Did you ever find out any other reason than she was uncomfortable?
I did. You know, this was news. And in fact, you know, I was getting hammered by all the press, all the media. I'm talking New York Times, Washington Post, ABC News, you know, a lot of, I had a camera crew on my front porch.
Oh, so the media was contacting you after you left.
How did they find out?
Well, they I don't know how they found out, but Mrs. Bush found out too, because she called me home that night.
Oh,
and she said, she didn't know what the reason was. She says, Chris, I'm so sorry. Is there anything we can do? And I said, well, I don't know what to ask you to do. I don't know what happened. And so the Washington Post kept asking me to go on the record. And I said, no, I'm not, you know, for 8 years, the job is never to talk to the press. And then here's an irony. I got a call from Maggie Williams, who Mrs. Clinton's chief of staff. And she said, if you get any calls from the press, refer them back to the White House. I hung up the phone. And I said, wait a minute. You guys just fired me. I'm supposed to refer my calls back to you now?
Wow.
Control the narrative.
The Post did their digging, and they learned that the Clinton White House had discovered that I had had two phone conversations in my office at the White House with Barbara Bush. And that, they believed, was an incredible lack of discretion on my part, and that should not happen.
Wow.
Wait a minute. I talked to Barbara Bush. It was about the computer I set up for her when she left. She lost a chapter of her book she's working on the West Coast. She lost a chapter, and it worked perfect.
Wow.
So I helped her recover it, and that was it. But, you know, what drives me nuts is my job in the usher's office is always to take calls from first ladies. I talked to Mrs. Johnson. I talked to Mrs. Carter, Mrs. Reagan. You know, they just typically would call, like, Mrs. Johnson, such a sweet lady, Lady Bird Johnson. She's also very lonely. She called and she goes, Chris, Lyndon planted a tree in 1965 near the tennis court. Can you tell me what that tree was?
Oh,
I go look it up. I go look it up and call her back and tell her what it was. And she's great. And then she called me the next night. There's a painting in the green room by John Singer Sargent. Can you tell me about that? I said, yes, mosquito. It's called the mosquito net. Anyway, that was typical. And for some reason, the Clinton White House decided that, well, if he's talking to Barbara Bush, he's sharing secrets with her.
Jeez.
I'm thinking, first of all, this is Barbara Bush would never listen if I had any, I would never do it. But if I did, she would say, Chris, I'm not interested in this. You know, this, the whole thing was so preposterous, made no sense. But so the reason,
how ironic.
So the Washington Post asked me to go on the record after they told me why I was fired. And I made a statement about Mrs. Clinton being paranoid or something like that. It was so funny.
How ironic. She was uncomfortable around the computer guy. That's all I'm
saying. Hey, we weren't going to get political, right?
That's fine. I guess not. I think you got
it's just fact. I'm just relating
facts. That's what it is.
Wait, I have a question about the book before you move on to the next one. One part of the book you wrote about dancing.
Yeah.
You want to tell that story?
Yeah, that was a great story. That was actually Hillary's birthday is around Halloween. And in Halloween of 93, her staff, it was a surprise party for Hillary for her birthday. And so they went to some Hollywood production costume place and got costumes. And we were all dressed up as colonial era. I was Paul Revere. The president was James Madison, which is crazy because Bill Clinton's like 6'2". James Madison's like 5'1". But anyway, and Mrs. Clinton was Dolly Madison. But anyway, she came down and there was like 100 guests and they were totally surprised. And so there was a party. So we were all having a good time. And I was in the East Room. There's live music. And Barbara Kinney, one of the White House photographers, grabbed me and pulled me out on the dance floor to start dancing.
Hmm.
And of course, as an usher, we're supposed to be in the background just watching. We're not supposed to partake. and so there I was dancing, you know, to live music. And right next to me are Bill and Hillary Clinton. Meanwhile, the rest of the resident staff that are working are looking at me like, oh, my gosh, this guy's really he's cooked. What is he doing out there?
To be fair, though, a female photographer pulls you onto the dance floor. I would think a very polite usher would do what the photographer wanted them to do. I think that was a gentlemanly thing to do. Yeah. OK, go ahead.
Yeah, that was a fun time. That's actually the best party I ever attended at the White House, I have to admit.
Wow. OK, you've got the next question, Angie.
All right, let's move on. And your book, White House Usher, Stories from the Inside, has lots more very interesting stories like that. So everybody needs to snatch up that book because it's awesome.
Actually, yeah. One other thing to wrap up the Usher book is this book has actually gotten you interviewed several times on news programs, if I'm correct.
It has. And probably my highest honor was last October. I got to be a keynote speaker at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California.
That's incredible.
Wow.
Wow.
And there was 170 guests. It was a wonderful time. But the biggest challenge was when I first got there for the reception, they say, hey, do you mind? The people were hoping you could sign their books. I said, sure. So I sit down. There's 170 people lined up.
With your book. Wow.
That's incredible.
Sign their books and I have to do this like within 20 minutes so we can start the dinner. It's crazy.
How fast can he sign? You need to take a stamp.
Yeah, no kidding.
Signatures.
Have an auto pen.
Oh, that was good.
I should have.
Very nice, Brian.
Believe it or not, January 20th of this year, I was interviewed. I did 8 live interviews. And I was thinking, why this inaugural? And I thought, I sort of realized, well, you know, I'm one of the last people still walking that worked for President Reagan. It's, you know, the running out of people.
Wow.
Right. Because you were messaging me saying, okay, on this date, I'm on this one. Yeah. On this day, and I've got 3 lined up for this day. And a lot of them were live.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah. Half of them were live.
Yeah. That's incredible. And you did great. You did fantastic.
It was fun. It was great fun.
All right. Who killed the president? Now, one thing we love to hear about from authors, especially fiction, is backstories. So aside from the fact that you were a White House usher, how did you get the idea to write about, you know, who killed the president? And were you fearful at any point when you were going to release that book, what that might do?
I wouldn't say fearful. I had some concerns. I was curious how it would go. But the reason I did that, believe it or not, working late at night in the usher's office, you know, I'm talking midnight, you know, waiting for to go home, be sent home. A lot of times the agents would hang out in my office and the uniform officers of the Secret Service. And we sit here and we would talk about scenarios. You know, what would it take to get into the White House right now? What would happen here? What would happen if someone, an intruder, made it up to the private residence? And so we always talked about this kind of stuff. So I had all these ideas, and I thought, you know, that's what's in this book, Who Killed the President? Exactly that. In fact, there's a scene where the scenario of discussing scenarios is actually part of the book.
So do you want to give us just kind of the Reader's Digest version of what this book is about without any spoilers, but, you know, just the basic plot?
Sure. Well, the book starts with Bartholomew Winston. He's my character, who's the chief usher. And he just happens to have an uncanny resemblance to Morgan Freeman, just to give you for context.
Oh, cool.
He's sitting in the usher's office at 5 a.m. with the Washington Post on his lap, screaming headline, President dead, usher in custody. Wow. And so the story starts there. Next thing, he's being interviewed by the FBI. But the whole story is about the president is murdered in the White House, and this Bartholomew Winston is kind of the lead of the unofficial group that's investigating what really happened, because one of his staff has been taken into custody, and it just shocks everybody because nobody can believe this individual could have been involved. So it's really a whodunit. It's a great DC whodunit. There's a lot of the places in DC people are recognized. But I actually received about this book, I received calls from all 3 of the administrations I worked for, from senior people who thanked me because they said the book was so detailed. When they read it, they felt like they were back at the White House.
Oh, that's great. Wow.
Yeah, that's really special.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a good whodunit. And it's a lot of people, you know, be halfway through the book and tell me who did it. And I say, keep reading. No one's ever guessed it.
Oh, that's awesome.
There's some twists.
Everybody loves a whodunit. That's fantastic. And it's got, you know, historical.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's great. Great.
So, okay. So the next fiction book you wrote, Who Killed the Speaker?
Right now, I'm wondering who he's going to take out.
Wait a minute. I apologize. I wrote that wrong. Who shot the speaker, right?
Well, you know, it's funny because originally it was going to be who killed the speaker. But as I wrote the book, the character of the speaker of the house, a female, as I wrote it, I liked the character. So I decided I don't want to kill her.
Okay.
Just going to shoot her. Just going to hurt her. Yeah.
So what's the backstory behind this one?
That's actually a sequel to Who Killed the President. A lot of the same characters are in it. A lot of the scenes are also occur in the White House, but now there's more focus on the Capitol. You know, I spent 8 years on Capitol Hill working all over Capitol Hill in the building. I worked for the U.S. Congress. So there's a lot of really cool chase scenes and things that occur in the Capitol of areas people don't know about. And the characters are just fabulous. But it's basically another whodunit. Some of the same folks from the first book are involved. So it's a foreign entity, which you can probably guess. But it's just another adventure type of book, murder, almost murder. I mean, there are people killed, but not the main characters.
Yeah, and readers have to figure out who that foreign entity is and how they got in there. And yeah, great.
Okay, so we started work on this book, according to our records, in August 2023. Now, Nancy Pelosi had been speaker up until January 3rd of that year, and then Kevin McCarthy was elected speaker on January 7th. Was there any correlation between who was the speaker and your decision to write this book?
I've had people ask me that seriously.
I'm not the only one that thinks like that, okay?
You write this book. And I never really said Nancy, but you could see possibly how she could do that.
I see. Okay. Okay. I think Angela's got some questions about marketing for you.
Sure. Well, we already briefly touched on this, but when the current president was elected, that was January 20th, you were on all those news networks. Can you name some of them or all of them? Because they're very impressive.
Oh, yeah. Well, Today Show, that was the most fun. We're walking down the street next to in Jackson Place, which is right across from the White House. So, yeah, I have a link on my website to that interview.
Okay.
Newsmax, News Nation, Voice of America. There was CNN. CNN was fun. I actually went there and I sat on the panel next to what's his name, with the guy that's on every night. But I was on the panel, and you know, they did makeup and everything. I'm wearing a suit. Unfortunately, the entire 20 minutes I was on, they were doing street scenes of the inaugural, and I never got any camera time. It just voice stuff.
It didn't get your minute in the limelight that time, huh?
Well, a lot of people people call me and say, "Hey, I heard you on CNN, but it was, you know, they mentioned you in the caption that you were speaking, but they didn't show you."
Well, you got plenty of other coverage, that's for sure. How did you get those interviews? Did you reach out to those outlets, or did they hear about you on one and reach out to you?
No, that's the strangest thing. You know, I've done a lot of interviews over the years. But you know, those crews change, the personnel change often in the networks. So I don't know how all of a sudden somehow they say, "Oh yeah, we found you on something." And they said, "Can you come in and talk to us?" And I said, "Of course." It was easy. I mean, they were asking me about what's happening, who's moving what, you know, because in that short 7 hour period from the time the president's sworn in, we're still moving out the old family, and the new family, we're moving in their stuff. And there's a complete transition, and it's been going that way forever in the history of the White House. So
yeah,
they just asked a lot of questions about that. It was fun.
Well,
there's another book I wrote. I co-wrote with a former boss from Capitol Hill. It's called The AI Candidates. And you guys published that for me. And that's a great book. It's a story about how artificial intelligence is taking over the U.S. elections. And caveat is, I said, folks, this isn't just fiction. It's already happening.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
We are knee deep in ACE AI stuff right now. But yeah, we will put a link to that book under the writersweekly.com/podcast link as well under this episode for sure. Yeah. You can start us on the AI stuff, man. It's become a daily problem. It really has. Yeah. You were way ahead of your time with that.
Yeah.
I'm so bad.
Not right before the election.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can tell you that in the past 3 weeks, we've had to implement a policy. We run every single manuscript that's submitted to us through an AI, three AI detectors. I know it's been in the news for a while, but it was not a problem for us until like a month ago. And then it exploded into a huge problem.
Yeah.
Huge problem. Right. So we received an email from an author. He said, one of your authors stole my book and didn't even, it went through it. The guy used AI, didn't tell us. That book is no longer on the market, by the way. The stolen one didn't tell us he used AI. That was before we started using it. That was the catalyst for us, you know, using three AI detectors. Didn't even bother to change the title of the book.
Oh my gosh.
And this poor author wrote, super professional, never said, I'm going to sue you or anything. He'd already contacted Amazon, told Amazon, look, it's a complete copy of my book. It wasn't an exact copy, but he never figured out how the AI software companies got a copy of his entire manuscript and put it in their systems. Yeah, it's very scary. So your books are selling well. You're doing really, really well. And I'm not going to tell people how much money you've made because we don't do that. We don't do that. But your books are doing very well. And of course you've had a lot of press and everything. Other than, you know, all those zillion interviews you've had and all that interest from everybody and the fact that you're just an awesome, very entertaining person. This is the first podcast episode where somebody said three different things that made me cry because I laughed so hard. So Brian's been sitting here watching me wipe my eyes. What primary marketing techniques do you use to promote your books?
I gotta believe I've tried everything. Other than just, I have a good following on LinkedIn, which I think is a dying network, but
I think so too.
I post stuff out there about my books.
Are you on Facebook?
Facebook and Twitter. I've got a big following on Twitter. But Twitter's only other authors. It's like everybody's doing the same thing, you know, read my book. And it's like, okay, it's all authors talking to authors. So it's not really reaching the right audience. I think Facebook might be one of the more successful areas.
Yeah, we see not only more book sales coming from promotion on Facebook, and I'm not talking about paid ads. I'm talking about just, you know, getting your word out there and getting a lot of followers and asking people to share your posts with other people. So it's not just authors reading. But I can also tell you that we get more traffic to writersweekly.com through Facebook than any other social media outlet by far.
Yeah.
By far. Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff Facebook does that I don't like, but they do send us a lot of business.
They have some weird policies. When I was trying to advertise the Who Killed the President, they kept saying this doesn't pass our standards. And I said, what are you talking about? You know, because
I understand. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, no, I just see it, guys. This is a fiction story. Okay, I made it up.
Yeah.
And you know, but anyway, I fought with them on that, but they really angered me. But yeah, I'm not probably serious enough in marketing as I should be. I've been very fortunate. I have a great topic.
Yeah.
A very rare thing.
Yep.
And so I've been lucky.
I think Brian's about to tell you the story about Brian and I both lost our personal Facebook accounts.
Well, how did you know?
Several years ago. Brian got to tell the story.
I was just going to mention right after I wrote my book, which is basically my experience in police work. And this was around 2020 during the BLM stuff. And all Angie and I did was put my book up on our Facebook page. You know, hey, here's a great book about, it's pro cop and it's, you know, stories about my experiences on the street and everything. And, you know, get this book as it's not anti-cop. And yeah, Facebook didn't just take the post down. They actually deleted our accounts.
Like simultaneously within hours. It's Blue Lives Matter, the heart behind the badge. And it tells the stories of when Brian was a cop and he was a really good cop and a very caring person. And we just basically put the title up there and the cover of the book. And with, I think, 3 or 4 hours,
Yeah.
We both lost our personal Facebook pages and we appealed and they wouldn't accept it. And it
that's terrible.
You know that they didn't, they just looked at the words Blue Lives Matter and that's all they looked at. And they I lost years of videos and pictures and connections and just boom, gone.
Yeah. Social media is pretty finicky about what they want you to show and what they don't want you to show.
We should have had Chris contact Facebook on our behalf because his book got up.
Right. By now they've deleted all our files. Who knows?
I got another question because, you know, a lot of authors listen to our podcast. What is the secret for authors to have ongoing sales? Usually you release a book, sell a bunch of copies, and then things level off and then things start to go, you know. So what, in your opinion, what is the secret for ongoing book sales years after you've published a book?
I don't know if it's a secret, but I'll suggest one thing I did that's kind of rare is I actually put my email address in the back of my book. And I said, I hope you enjoyed such and such, you know, please share your thoughts. And believe it or not, over the years, I've gotten hundreds of emails. I call them fan mail because they're always very complimentary of my writing.
Yeah.
So I'll usually follow up with that. And I say, by the way, if you check my website, because there's a lot of pictures of me at the White House and, you know, I'll give them some other history and maybe share a different story and just keep that dialogue going, which to me is fun. I don't know if that's really helping, but I certainly get a loyal following, it seems like. They're very interested in what I'm doing, what I'm writing now, and all that stuff. So it's kind of cool.
From a marketing standpoint, it is really important that your customers, your readers, feel like they have a personal connection with you. And if you, I'm talking to all authors, if you have the time and are willing to devote the time, and if you're, you know, a nice person like Chris and very polite and everything, letting your fans contact you and writing back to them, they love that.
Yeah.
They absolutely love that. Yeah.
You know, it blows them away. On occasion, they'll write to me and their phone number's in there. And I'll be sitting here, I've just written like five of these emails. I said, okay, I'm going to call this person. And I mean, they're blown out of the water. They say, wow. Oh my gosh, I can't believe you're calling me. I say, yeah, I just thought it'd be easier for us to talk. And, you know, thank you for your email. Here's some things I wanted to mention and share with you. It's like, it's unbelievable, the reaction.
That gets that person to tell more friends about what a great guy this author is.
Yeah.
Chris, I wanted to mention about your pictures. I love the one of you behind Ronald Reagan holding the umbrella. I read that story. It reminds me so much of it almost looks like a Forrest Gump moment where you just kind of appear in that picture. It's like, hey, that's Chris Everett.
Well, you know, the quick story behind that, it was Gorbachev, the summit in December of 87. And he was leaving the White House after being there for a week. By the way, I was in charge of press setup for that entire event. It was driving me nuts. So he was leaving, and my boss says to me, he says, the ushers, you need to hold the umbrellas. You know, we're not going to let the butlers do this because that would just not look right. Because most of the butlers are African-American, and he was right. We already had rumors that the White House was the last plantation, so we didn't want to make things worse.
Oh, my word.
Okay. So my job was to cover Mrs. Reagan. So they all come out of the South Portico in the rain, and I hold my umbrella up, and I can't find Mrs. Reagan. And meanwhile, the KGB are bumping us out of the way. We can't get close to Gorbachev. And so I'm lost. And so I end up on the dais, and I see Mrs. Reagan there with her own umbrella. So okay, I failed. but then the president's standing at the podium. There's no umbrella over the president.
Oh, my God.
So I step forward, hold the umbrella over him. And he reaches into his vest pocket and he pulls out an index card where he's written his comments. Now, he's written these in a fountain pen. Words are running together. I'm thinking, he can't read this. And President Reagan was so cool. He looks down without reacting. He says, okay, that's not going to work. He just slowly slips it back in his vest pocket and he just starts talking. It was amazing.
Well, I got one final question. What are you working on next?
That's great. Thanks for asking. So I'm working on a book about a woman. Her name's Jacqueline. That's the title of the book. She is a 16-year-old in May 1940 when the Germans occupy Paris. She's French. It's the story of her life and how she survived World War II. There have been some amazing things that I've uncovered from research for this book. She actually ended up in Germany during a lot of the war. We're not sure whether she was a spy or a double spy, what she was doing. At the end of the war, she comes back from Germany. The French condemn her to death. She's sentenced to death. Then somehow the Americans and British step in, rescue her, take her to Vietnam. And she, for the next 2 years, was in Saigon working on intel, because the Americans back then were spying on the Japanese. Because when the war ended in Europe, it was still going on in the Pacific. So in Saigon, Vietnam is the closest place the U.S. could go and you know, do their espionage stuff. So she worked in this office. She came back. She happens to meet an American aviator, and they end up getting married. So she comes to this country. So there's a lot of details between, and I'm still researching. This is an epic novel. Now,
don't give away the ending.
Point. Jacqueline is my mother.
Wow.
I was going to ask you, who is she based on? Wow.
Yeah. So this is really fun to write. It's for every chapter I complete, I can do in a few days. I then have to spend almost 2 weeks authenticating the touch points with history, because this is based on a true story, and it's historic. So she was involved in so much, and there are things that are just astonishing. And my two sisters are contributing to this. Basically, they're just reading my drafts. But but we talk about it, and there's been some shock. I'll share one tidbit. She had a baby in 1942 when she was 19. And so we've recently learned that baby is still alive and living in France.
You have a sibling you didn't know about. Yeah, wow. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah. So this has been this I'm hoping to have it out working with you all next fall.
Okay.
It's going to take me that long.
And I want to
be here.
We're going to be here. I want to point out to, all our listeners that when you're writing historical fiction, it is so very important to get the facts right, even though it's fiction. Well, Chris is already an amazing author, and spending this much time on that, telling your mother's story, is just amazing. It's even better if it's historical fiction you're writing about your relative. We've actually had a few authors do that, but I can't wait to read this one. This sounds awesome.
He passed away in 2010, and none of us knew any of this.
How did you find out?
Well, my biggest source is amazing. A German officer who was stationed in France. They fell in love. They got engaged. They actually had their rings blessed by the Catholic priest, and they were going to be married, but as the war goes on, things didn't work. By the way, this guy, he wasn't just your normal German. He actually was helping the French resistance, and he was also involved in Valkyrie, the assassination plot on Hitler. Yeah.
Wow.
This guy was one of the key architects of that. And I have all this information because he wrote a book. But what's key about his book is an entire chapter written about my mother.
That's incredible.
I have a feeling I can imagine what happened to him. Believe it or not,
when the plot failed, he went back to his room at the Peninsula Hotel in Paris, waited to be arrested. They never came for him.
Really? Wow.
Wow.
Because Hitler had 5,000 people assassinated or executed over that plot.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Amazing. Incredible. Amazing. It's shocking what kind of history you have when you dig down.
What was, so he wrote a book about it?
He wrote a book about his life.
Do you remember the title of that?
Yeah, it's in German, sitting right here.
Never mind. You know what? Maybe you should translate
that. Take a picture of it and send it to me.
I'm trying to say it. Well,
the book is called Hotel Majestic. And Hotel Majestic was a hotel in Paris that the Germans used as their offices during the war. Okay. And so he talks all about his life and what he did. I mean, he's amazing. I just converted this last 2 weeks ago to English for the first time.
You do that through Google Translate? Did you do that through Google Translate?
I did.
Hey, you know what? That works. It actually works. It says,
It's very basic, but I can read it, and that's what's important.
We are seeing increasing numbers of authors emailing us and writers to want to write for writersweekly.com sending us emails in a different language, and I just translate it, translate.google.com, read it,
yeah,
type my answer in there, translate it back, send it back. Yeah, it's really good. I mean, surprisingly
it's
good.
It's getting better. It's getting better by the week. I mean, yeah. It's amazing, that capability.
Well, what an easy way to research something when you get a foreign language book and you just have to copy paste. There it is. That's great. Well, I can't wait to read Jacqueline. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good one coming up.
Are you going to put pictures in it?
Yes, there are quite a few, actually.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's great.
This is so invigorating. I mean, as far as my style of writing, I'll work really heavily on this for 2 or 3 weeks. And then I take like 2 weeks off. I mean, it's just the way I do it. And it helps me recharge batteries and keep going. But this book, I would imagine it's going to be well over 400 pages.
It's interesting. So work 2 or 3 weeks, take 2 weeks off. We hear the, write 2 hours every morning thing, 7 days a week. I think writing 2 to 3 weeks and taking 2 weeks off sounds great. I wonder if I can do that with my regular job.
It's like a truck driver, right?
It actually, though, it sounds like a really good way to refresh your brain. And then you go back and look at what you just wrote and continue on with your research and everything. That's a really good idea. That's a good tip for authors. Yep.
Yeah, I know the great authors have their regimented ways of doing things. I am not at all regimented. So, but that seems to work for me, because if I just sit here, I did actually, I think who killed the president, I kind of sat and wrote straight through. But I really think you need a break. And hey, I've got nothing else. So this works well.
Yeah. Well, that's really good advice.
Well, Chris, we definitely appreciate you coming on board and talking with us. For our listeners, it's White House Usher, Stories from the Inside, Who Killed the President, a fictional book, and also Who Shot the Speaker, all available at booklocker.com or Amazon or anywhere you get. And he's also got out now the AI Candidates. All of these will be linked to on writersweekly.com/podcast.
Under this episode
yep. Here. Anything, any last thoughts you'd like to add with us?
Any other juicy stories?
I want to, again, express my appreciation to Angela. Angela, you have no idea how great you were for me 7 years ago when this started. And even today, I just, your counsel, your friendship and your help has just been unparalleled by anything I ever expected. You far exceeded expectations.
Well, I have to tell you, you're a super sweet guy. Really, really sweet. I love you to death. And you're really freaking funny, man. You're hilarious. I've loved working with you. Every single time we talk, it's email dashboard. Yeah. It's a pleasure. We always love hearing from you. So yeah, I'm glad you gave us a lot of exposure and we helped you, get your books out there fast. And it turned out to a great partnership and even a better friendship. So yeah. And I can't wait to see Jacqueline. Yeah.
Yes. I can't wait for you to see it.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Well, Brian, you need to wrap this up.
Okay. Well, if you have a great book you'd like published, come on over to booklocker.com. That's booklocker.com. We're a full service publishing company, and we'll get your book out within 1 month of all of your interior files being completed. And
cover files too.
Oh, and cover files.
We do it in
1 month. And we make you a book trailer, and there's you got lots of stuff that.
We also just launched our audiobook program.
Well, you told me earlier we weren't going to talk about that. Okay. Yes, we just launched an audiobook program, and there will be
explain it later.
There will be more details on that later. All right, everybody, we appreciate you listening to us, and we will see you again on the next episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Don't hang up, Chris.